Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, Cloud Peak Energy is thinking of selling its company.
This really looks like a desperation move by a company that's having a real hard time making a go of it in today's market.
Defense Secretary James Mattis visits Wyoming to meet with the Philippine ambassador to the U.S. about a pair of bells.
We return these bells with consideration of our present, but also with the utmost respect of our past.
In October, the Department of Workforce Services released a study on the gender wage gap in Wyoming. Now, legislators will have to decide what to do with that information.
We've got an opportunity to kind of correct a problem here.
And the Albany County Attorney discusses her release of a video to the media. Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Cloud Peak Energy has announced it will review strategic alternatives. That means it's open to major changes, including a potential sale of the company, in order to improve its financial situation. The move was announced alongside bonuses to executives, encouraging them to stay on. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim sorts it out.
Cloud Peak Energy is one of the largest coal producers in the U.S., with two mines in Wyoming. In 2015, it avoided risky bets in a new coal market and, along with it, bankruptcy. But it hasn't avoided the tough headwinds facing coal everywhere. On November 13th, Cloud Peak Energy saw its share prices drop to a 52-week low, $1.32. It's seeing customers move away from coal in the near future, with declining profit margins and production. Its shipments this past quarter were down 15% from last year. And perhaps most importantly, Cloud Peak faces a massive looming debt payment of over $290 million in 2 years.
The bottom line here is that Cloud Peak probably sees the handwriting on the wall.
That's Clark Williams-Derry, the director of energy finance at Sightline Institute, an environmental research center. He says this pursuit of strategic alternatives is one of the most disruptive decisions a company can make.
This really looks like a desperation move by a company that's having a real hard time making a go of it in today's market. And the best plan may be just to sell itself.
And the announcement shows Cloud Peak is receptive to becoming a different company, selling off, or even breaking up into parts. In its announcement, Cloud Peak said it's also possible no transactions could occur. But with the company's current trajectory, Williams-Derry says it's hard to imagine how else Cloud Peak will pay off its hundreds of millions of dollars in debt. This isn't the first sign Cloud Peak has been hurting. At the end of October, the company made a controversial decision to end medical benefits for retirees to save the company money. Benefits will end by 2019, then retirees will receive a lump sum of next year's benefits. This decision isn't taken lightly by the people it affects most.
I did my part. I worked safely for 20 years, and 4 months after I retire, this is what's done. It's maddening.
That's Ann Zollinger. She was a Cloud Peak Energy employee working mostly as a warehouse technician. She retired this past May at age 55. She expected $600 a month to help pay her insurance bills until she was eligible for Medicare at 65.
What I was promised and worked for, and now it's gone by no cause of my own. I feel very powerless to change this. This is a decision that they made in spite of the number of retirees that they had.
The company had no additional comments beyond its press releases and filings. But University of Wyoming energy economist Rob Godby helps explain the healthcare decision. He says cutting post-retirement healthcare makes the company look more valuable, especially given its rough short-term earnings. It provides them with $19.5 million in net income for this quarter, and more for next year. He says you can't cut production if the goal is to keep looking attractive to investors. So this was just low-hanging fruit.
They're looking at any sorts of financial obligations or fixed costs that they can avoid, and they're trying to cut that off their balance sheet just to make themselves more profitable.
Yet filings on the day of Cloud Peak's announcement to change strategies show bonuses to six corporate executives. They're called retention agreements. In five payments over 2 years, the bonuses would provide up to 100% of each person's base salary in order to keep them on through, quote, ongoing challenges. Using 2017 government filed numbers, that adds up to over $2 million. It sends a message to people like Zollinger, the former employee whose medical benefits were cut.
It seems so unjust. The people that are in the trenches doing the work get the shaft, and the people at the top of the food chain are making out like bandits.
CloudPeak's problems come down to a tough market with a lot of supply and even fewer customers, with no sign things will get better. UW economist Godby says selling its company or even just assets like mines could help get them out of a financial hole. It could allow CloudPeak to get rid of its liabilities while finding the money it needs to pay off its huge debts.
And they may be hoping that the value they can get in those sales is greater than, say, some of the profits they would get if they continued to operate over time.
In CloudPeak's announcement, it said there's no timeline for this process and that it would not release updates. The question now being batted around by market analysts and economists is who could acquire CloudPeak Energy. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
The Wyoming legislature has a long history of exploring ways to get quality and affordable insurance to more citizens. But for a variety of reasons, nothing has really ever worked. The legislature has long opposed accepting federal dollars to expand Medicaid due to fears that the money would eventually dry up and the state would have a program it could no longer afford. But there's not an available state solution either. This year, a legislative committee started kicking the tires on a proposal by the insurance commissioner where the state could use what's called a 1332 waiver and create a program that could reduce the premiums for citizens who are in the federal marketplace or exchange. The state has hired consultants to develop the plan, but it has a ways to go. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
Terms like waivers and reinsurance probably make your eyes glaze over, but for people who get their insurance from the Affordable Care Act's federal exchange, a proposal being developed for the state under the 1332 waiver, which allows states to try innovative insurance programs, could reduce premium costs, especially for those who don't get subsidies to buy insurance. Reinsurance is where an insurance company would see its risk reduced or its exposure to a catastrophic event reduced. The plan is to put the sicker and more high-risk people into a separate reinsurance pool in the state. State Insurance Commissioner Tom Glaus wants to use a combination of state and federal dollars to pay for any catastrophic event that could occur.
That improves the overall risk of the pool and lowers insurance rates. What you realize then is some savings from federal pass-through dollars that can be used to fund that reinsurance pool.
Wyoming gets money to provide low-income residents a subsidy to pay for the high cost of insurance. Glaus says it's that federal money that the state could use to fund a good chunk of the reinsurance pool.
About 95% of the population on the exchange receives a subsidy. So if we drive the premiums down, we drive the subsidies down, and the government then allows those savings from the subsidies to be passed through to fund a reinsurance pool.
Some legislators have worried that it sounds too good to be true. But Wendy Curran of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Wyoming, the only carrier available through the exchange, says she's interested in the plan and says in a place like Wyoming, where there is a small population, this could work.
So that should, in theory, lower the cost for the insured population and still assure that those who would be in the high-risk pool would still be getting reasonable and affordable premiums as well.
Ann Ladd heads up the Wyoming Business Coalition on Health. They have worked for years to try and find ways to get people better and more affordable insurance.
I think it could work. I know that we have had a negative experience with a high-risk pool in the past, but at that point we were telling people you have to apply to the high-risk pool and you have to pay the full premium for that high-risk pool. And so as a result, the premiums were very high. Nobody went into it.
Ladd says with state and federal dollars keeping premiums for that high-risk population low, that makes this unique. The key is that the entire pool is not paying for a high-risk case.
So yes, we're asking the state to take on the additional risk, the state and the federal government, of covering these very sick people so that the rest of the population can have a lower premium and pay more reasonable cost for their coverage.
Ladd thinks it's something the state should certainly try. Wendy Curran of Blue Cross Blue Shield agrees, but she adds that the new waiver rule gives the state the opportunity to try a lot of things.
I think that that's the beauty of this, is that the waiver, particularly with the new flexibility that was just recently announced, lets people have that discussion that says, what makes sense for Wyoming?
Insurance Commissioner Tom Glaus and the consultants will unveil their plan and projected costs to the legislature's Joint Health, Labor, and Social Services Committee on Monday. It could be a tough audience, though. Longtime Senate Committee Chairman Charles Scott has been skeptical and referred to it as a something-for-nothing scheme. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, we will be joined by the Albany County Attorney, who discusses her decision to release the video of an officer shooting to the media while an investigation is going on. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Albany County Attorney Peggy Trent made the unusual decision this week to allow a piece of evidence to be made available to the media. She allowed the release of a law enforcement video, including a body cam that showed an encounter between an Albany County Sheriff's deputy and a Laramie resident that resulted in the resident being shot and killed. Normally, such evidence would be held until a trial, but she explains why she wanted it released.
At the time I made the decision, I was familiar with the Wyoming Public Records Act. I know in the past legislative session there was a lot of dialogue regarding the release of video cameras on officers, whether it be in their vehicles or cameras. So when the decision, you know, was coming forward to release that video to the public or in a certain form, I gave thoughtful consideration of all of the discussions I had heard in the previous legislative session, equally from law enforcement as well as from the public and the need to know. At that point, I believed that the investigation was far enough along that any release in a certain form would not compromise the investigation that was being conducted by the Wyoming Division of Criminal Investigation. So at that point, in looking at all of those factors, I felt that there was, from all the social media I was reading, that there was concern for safety and concern of what had happened in the community. I thought that some of the information that was getting out was inaccurate or incomplete, and there needed to be, for our community, some way to get the information out there in a thoughtful way or some way in order that we can let them know what happened, but at the same time balance and not compromise an investigation. So I made the decision to release the video in a format of a press conference where Undersheriff DeBrie from the sheriff would in fact walk through where the process of the cameras and how they're set up.
There are people that are asking that you release it to them or organizations that want, again, a more public presentation. I understand you're against that.
At this point, state statute under Wyoming Public Records Act specifically indicates when you have an ongoing criminal investigation that it is the prosecutor's call of whether to release a video. This type of review that I am conducting right now and along with the investigation with DCI is basically looking into whether the facts and circumstances warranted the use of force that was in this case and whether it was justified or not, and if it was not justified, potential criminal prosecution. Having a video out there that people are replaying and doing all of the details was concerning to me because we were still investigating certain portions of that shooting, and that could compromise the investigation.
This is, this has become a volatile situation, and let's face it, the officer has an interesting background that has attracted some attention. There are people that want to know more about him. They want to know personnel records. They want to know, why did we hire him in the first place and revisit some of that kind of thing? Why is that a bad idea to talk about?
Well, again, under Wyoming Public Records Act, it does prohibit, and it says, I shall deny the release of personnel rights and records, which are privacy, during this item. Now, this will be, later down the line, after this portion is done, there also will be a personnel action. So at this time, those records are not, to be released. And that one is, I am not prohibited by law. So that's another exception under the Public Records Act, which guides me in the release of information.
Are you giving more information than you typically would have given?
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I believe I'm the only prosecutor in the state of Wyoming to date that made a decision such as this to release a tape during a pending investigation. But I felt strongly and that it was important for the public. We have a lot of, from the social media I'm reviewing, a lot of civil unrest and concerns. And we as a community need to be open as we're moving forward. And I feel we are doing a thoughtful process and investigation that we could do both.
There's going to come a time, obviously, in the not too distant future where you're going to make a decision on what to do here. Do you plan on being very open and talkative about that?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, as unfortunately in other shootings we've had in our community, I give a detailed description in a letter explaining why, what were the facts and circumstances that were the basis for my decision of whether use of force was justified or not. And I do believe in this particular case, I will do such. Depending upon what my decision is, I do envision at a later date the tape being released in its entirety. I'm very apprehensive and thoughtful to the family's wishes to have their son, their grandson, or sibling to be on social media watching him being, shot and killed. And at this point, I think that factors into how that gets out. But I feel at some point it does need to be released and discussions have to be had. So as we move on, a community to hear what the concerns are so we can learn and move on and be accountable to the public as elected officials and how we go forward with these type of incidents to do, better ways that practices we can implement.
Peggy Trent, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Democrats preparing to take over control of the U.S. House of Representatives in January are gunning for major battles on climate change and energy issues, which could hurt the economic gains witnessed in Wyoming in this Trump energy era. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Let's start with the good news for Wyoming. Liz Cheney, the state's lone member of the House, is now following her father's footsteps up the leadership ladder in the House. With a former vice president in the room, this week she was unanimously elected to the number 3 leadership spot in the House leadership team. That makes her the person charged with crafting the party's talking points. And as an advocate for all things fossil fuels, Cheney is ready to spur her party to spread that message far and wide.
We need to get on offense, and I think especially because we're in the minority now, we've got to be in a position where we're making sure that we're out there every day fighting.
But Cheney and House Republicans have been relegated to the minority in the House, which means they're basically powerless. And many of the fresh rising stars in the Democratic Party are going out of their way to pressure even their own party leaders to put up a huge fight when it comes to their goal of combating climate change. Here's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, who says she's willing to vote against Nancy Pelosi for Speaker unless she vows to make climate change a top agenda item in January.
Oh, yeah, because for me, this is not about supporting or not supporting an individual. It's about making sure that we can get as progressive and aggressive legislation as a party on climate change as quickly as possible. So, I think it's there's a total opening for sure.
While Democrats are itching for a fight over climate change, Republicans still control the upper chamber, and they're vowing to hold fast on pushing President Trump's energy agenda. And Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi says Democrats are powerless unless they get Senate Republicans on board.
Well, the House can't roll it back without the Senate's approval.
That doesn't mean Democrats won't try with everything they've got. Kathy Castor of Florida is on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And like many Democrats, she's itching for some revenge after her party was completely locked out of power for the past 2 years.
Well, I think it's very important that we elevate climate change in the next Congress. The Republicans completely stymied us.
Castor speaks for many in her party when she says they're going to make climate change a part of their legacy.
It's got to be elevated. We've got to decarbonize the atmosphere. We've got to do more on renewables. We've got to address these extreme weather events. People back home are crying out for action.
But Wyoming's junior senator, John Barrasso, is still set on trying to steer the president's pro-energy policy through the Capitol.
My focus is unleashing American energy. It's called the master resource for a reason. It powers our country, powers our economy and our military. We want to make sure that we can continue using all the sources of energy that we have.
Even with the two chambers divided come January, Barrasso sees a point of bipartisan compromise on climate change with attempts to capture and store carbon from coal plants. He says he favors more efforts like the Integrated Test Center in Gillette, which will use carbon capture and sequestration.
An effort to find a profitable use for the carbon. If you can turn this carbon through research and innovation and invention into something you can actually sell, then the demand for that carbon and the reason to capture it, it goes way up. And so we have bipartisan legislation to do that.
Democrats are vowing to make combating climate change a part of their legacy now that they've recaptured the House from Republicans. This battle is sure to become a brawl or a stalemate at some point in the new year, which means the issue is likely to also play a big role in the 2020 race for the White House. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Coming up, a couple of stories about teaching non-natives about Native American history and culture. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The United States has a grim history when it comes to our indigenous people. From the multiple massacres of Native men, women, and children to Indian boarding schools where Native children were taken from their families and in many cases physically and sexually abused. For the most part, this history is not taught in our public schools. Neither is indigenous culture. But that's changing, and the Mountain West is on board. Allie Budner reports.
Colorado's Department of Education is at a local library to unveil a new set of lessons for fourth graders.
The lesson that we're going to look at today looks at education for the Ute at the turn of the century.
The optional curriculum was written and approved by the state's two federally recognized tribes, the Southern Ute and the Ute Mountain Ute.
Stuff like this, children need to know.
Felicia Alvarez applauds the move. She's a local parent and a member of the Eastern Shoshone tribe.
I've always felt that within our education system, if we were to include true historical facts, that the children would be much more educated and there would be less ignorance towards our people.
Another parent is listening intently to the new lesson plans. Monica Snowbird is Anishinaabe, an indigenous group from around the Great Lakes area.
Our nation doesn't have any traditional ties to Colorado, but I've been here 25-ish years, and so my kids were all born and raised here.
Snowbird says her kids were lucky to have teachers who were willing to incorporate Native history, but she says it was concerned parents like her who had to provide the learning materials themselves, and that's a burden on parents.
So this is taking some of that burden away, so that's huge.
She welcomes the curriculum, but worries that it still falls short.
Like, I read the curriculum on Thanksgiving, and it didn't talk about really any of the horrific things that happened around that time.
that perspective is one that's been growing throughout Indian country.
Ernest House Jr. would know. Until very recently, he was the head of the Colorado Commission on Indian Affairs. He's a member of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe and oversaw the curriculum's development. He understands Snowbird's concerns, but says the decision to keep the lessons free of too much violent history was intentional, because it's for fourth graders. That's when Colorado schools start to focus on teaching the state's history.
There was a lot of conversations that we had that we wanted to put in this one, that we said, well, if we can put that in another one that came in middle school or in high school, is that an opportunity? And we decided that there would be this first step into this guide.
Meanwhile, Montana is way ahead of that first step.
Well, you know, Montana is unique.
Mike Jetty is an Indian education specialist for the state of Montana. He's also a member of the Spirit Lake Dakota Nation and a Turtle Mountain Chippewa descendant.
We're the only state in the country that has it written into our state constitution that will teach about American Indians. And that happened in 1972.
He says it took decades, but now not only is it in the Constitution, it's funded by the state government, so they can afford to reach all schools and all ages.
We're trying to hit every grade. You have a grade 4 science standard. We have references to Native American science. If you have a grade 8 social studies standard, we have tribal government and sovereignty written into that.
He says it's true some of this history can be painful and violent.
But at the same time, I think kids can handle stuff that we don't, give them credit for. It depends on how you present it and how that teacher does it.
Bottom line, he says, it's good for non-Native and Native students alike to understand our history. Ernest House Jr. agrees.
No matter what tribe you talk to, out of 573 federally recognized tribes, tribes want people just general population to know about them. We want them to know about our culture, our history, that we're still here. We're not a vanishing race, and that there's so much that our culture, that our tribal nations and our languages have provided to everyday life today.
And the Mountain West is listening. Utah has had its own curriculum on Native tribes since 2009, but like Colorado, it isn't mandatory. Meanwhile, Wyoming will roll out its new academic standards in 2021, requiring the inclusion of Indigenous history and culture at all grade levels. House says a thorough and honest understanding of our history is crucial.
We won't be able to start addressing much bigger, larger needs unless people have a baseline of American Indian history and the respect for that culture.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Allie Budner.
Across the country, Native American students are severely underrepresented in higher education. Only 16% of Native Americans have a bachelor's degree. That's compared to 42% of white students. But tribal leaders in Wyoming say a collective effort to increase support for Native American students is having an impact. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson has more.
From the outside, Wyoming Indian High School looks like your standard modern public school. Brick construction, flagpole, sports fields. But as I follow Fremont 14 Superintendent Owen St. Clair inside, we walk over blue and red linoleum tiles laid in an Arapaho design.
You won't see anything like that in any other school.
St. Clair says as a Native American educator on the Wind River Reservation, he has a duty to teach more than the state standards.
One thing that, people don't realize is that we still practice our culture here. Our mission statement is, being successful in both areas to make yourself a better person. And so we're pushing academics on one side, but yet we're a community of tradition and belief, or we're pushing our culture and tradition on the other side.
And Fremont 14's graduation rate went up from 35% to 63% in the last 2 years. But encouraging those high school graduates to pursue higher education is a bigger puzzle.
I think what we've discovered is that there isn't just one answer.
Roy Brown is the chairman of the Northern Arapaho Business Council. He says one big issue is how to pay for higher education. The median income for Native American families on the Wind River Reservation is less than half of what it is for households in the rest of Wyoming.
There's not a lot of historical information that's passed on from generation to generation about how to pay for college.
The more Native Americans who go to college, the easier it will be for future generations. Brown says removing barriers like tuition costs will help close the achievement gap sooner. He says, for example, more could be done to help Native American students get the state-funded Hathaway Scholarship. Typically, around 40% of Wyoming high school grads receive the scholarship. On the reservation, that number is consistently below 10%.
The Hathaway is really designed sort of as a one-size-fits-all. And, you know, it's tougher for our students to sort of fit that mold.
Brown says schools are torn between test prep or culture and traditions. He thinks the Hathaway should be more flexible, so superintendents like Owen St. Clair aren't put in that position. But Brown says his community is not just asking for changes. They've been taking action. Back in 1987, the Northern Arapaho Business Council established their own UW scholarship, but it hasn't grown big enough to accommodate increasing interest from Arapaho students.
Part of that, an extension of that work, is to come to the university and sort of explain the issues that we're having and see if there's a way to collaborate.
Collaborate on the idea of a tuition waiver as a way to support Native enrollment. That proposal is still under consideration, but Brown says UW has been doing more to respond to the needs of Native students. Michelle Sullivan is a UW trustee who serves on the Academic and Student Affairs Committee.
I think we find ourselves at a really interesting place right now where we have a combination of individuals who care deeply about this topic. Okay, well, we've got the will, but what does that look like in terms of how we really sustain it?
Sustaining support for Native students is also top priority for James Trosper. He's the director of the High Plains American Indian Research Institute at the University of Wyoming, and he was a student here in the 90s. At that time, there was an Indian education office on campus.
And I remember that place was just busy, bustling with students coming and going, and just really a lot of activity there.
Trosper says institutional priorities shifted, and that office went away. He says support for Native students has been inconsistent over the years. And for many in his community, that hits on a distrust for educational institutions that runs deep.
My grandmother had told me about the really clear memories that she had when the police came to her home and removed her from her family and took her to the boarding school.
Trosper says at the boarding school, kids were punished for speaking their language or practicing their culture.
That had to really been harmful to their self-esteem and to who they were as Native American people.
In those stories, Trosper hears lessons about the strength and resiliency of his family, but also a warning.
I really do feel like our people are torn because on the one hand, they want the young people to get an education, but at the same time, it was through education that a lot was taken away from our people.
To send a clear message that Native cultures and languages are welcome at UW, Trosper and many others worked with University President Lori Nichols to create the Native American Education Research and Cultural Center. Trosper has been advocating for a center like this for years.
And I think that the message that the University of Wyoming is supportive of Native American students is getting to the reservation because we are seeing some really positive things.
Last year, only 3 Native American students came straight to UW from high school. Often, they go to community college first. This year, that number has tripled. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
A new museum installation called Arapaho Roots is opening tomorrow in Colorado at the Museum of Boulder. The pieces will be animated Arapaho stories put up on screen throughout the museum. Jordan Dresser was asked to be the show's curator a year ago and has spent time working with the museum to tie in Native history and Native art. He works for the Tribal Historic Preservation Office for the Arapaho Tribe. At a coffee shop close to the Wind River Reservation, Dresser explained to Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner that he wants the exhibit to feel alive.
A new museum installation called Arapaho Roots is opening tomorrow in Colorado at the Museum of Boulder. The pieces will be animated Arapaho stories put up on screens throughout the museum. Jordan Dresser was asked to be the show's curator a year ago and has spent time working with the museum to tie in Native history and Native art. He works for the Tribal Historic Preservation Office for the Arapaho Tribe. He explained to me at a coffee shop close to the Wind River Reservation that he wants the exhibit to feel alive.
The exhibit's all animated, and it tells a story about the Arapaho people in 5 different videos and also an intro. But the whole space itself is, I wanted it to feel like you're walking into the land itself and you were surrounded by all these Arapaho people. So when you walk in, you see an image of different Arapaho people, and you also hear the words being spoken just in Arapaho. So I just love the feel of it. And I didn't want to do like traditional museum stuff. Like sometimes I feel like museums get stuck when they do exhibits about Native people. Like they'll do a lot of black and white photos. I love black and white photos, but you know, it's not always the best option. And then like sepia tone and just really making us in the past. So I love the idea of this exhibit because it's alive. And I wanted to get that message across that tribal people are alive and well. You know, we're all across this country. And I want people to walk away with a better understanding about Arapaho people, but also to think about their own personal roots and where they come from.
And you had all different age groups of Arapaho, like narrating these videos, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really lucky to have local community members all narrate the videos, and it's just this really good age range of different people and their voices, and I just wanted to layer it and have different textures. And
And you said you've been working on it for about a year now, and they approached you, and they've been relatively like easy to work with and stuff. That's not always been the case, right?
Yeah, museums can be difficult to work with, but they've been really open, and I think that they really taught me a lot about, you know, sometimes museums just want us to go in there as Native people and just say yes and just co-sign whatever they're doing. But this one taught me to really use my voice and to say like, no, I don't like this, or no, we should change this, and no, we're not doing that. You know, it taught me to do that and to do it in a good way and just be really strong in my opinions and how I feel.
Does Tipple get invited to go consult with different museums often, or?
Yeah, we do get invited to go out to different museums, look at their collections if they have specific questions about something that they feel like maybe, you know, not appropriate to view, or if they have some conservation problems, they'll come talk to us. And you know, it can go 50-50. You know, sometimes we can go out and you can just be combative with them because they're so defensive, you know, and they don't really want us to, I think they're just scared. I think museums are really scared that we're just going to go and take every single thing that they have. And if that was the case, we already done that, you know, but it's like when you go through their collection, sometimes you see things that you're just like, that's not cool to have, you know, why do you have that, you know? And they always, the big thing is always, they gave it to us. We're like, I doubt it. You know, I seriously doubt. You know, during the 1800s, a lot of these chiefs, a lot of these tribal people were like, let me give you this, you know. Most of the time it's probably stolen. Or if it was bought, it's probably bottom of the barrel prices. Because we were put on reservations, we were starving, we needed money, you know. So that's the reality of it.
Yeah. What's your favorite part about the exhibit? If you could pick one aspect of the thing you've created to kind of talk about a little bit.
My favorite part changes all the time. Like, it's the different videos. Each one tells a story within a different topic. So therefore, they're all very different. So as he was animating them, I'd be like, ooh, this one's my favorite. And then the next one come out, I'd be like, no, this one's my favorite. So it would just change all the time. But I think overall, my favorite part is that it's feels alive, and that it doesn't feel static, and it doesn't feel like you just walk into a space and you look at these items and you're just like, well, where are these people at? To me, it feels alive and it feels a connection, and that was the thing that I wanted to have a feeling.
Arapaho Roots opens tomorrow, November 17th, at the Museum of Boulder. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Don't you go to me,
When we come back, we'll look at new information surrounding Wyoming's wage gap. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. On Wednesday, Defense Secretary James Mattis made a visit to Wyoming. He was there to witness the formal turnover of the Bells of Ballingiga. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen was there for the ceremony in Cheyenne.
On the F.E. Warren Air Force Base, military officials gather in a small ballroom. The room is filled with anticipation before the man of the hour, Defense Secretary James Mattis, makes his big entrance. Servicemen and women stand as Mattis and Philippine Ambassador to the U.S., Jose Manuel G. Romaldez, walk to the front of the room. And then two captains sing the Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, say, can you see? By the dawn's early light.
The reason for all this pomp and circumstance is that this is a moment more than 100 years in the making. It was during the Philippine-American War that U.S. soldiers took the bells in 1901 from the village of Ballingiga. Shortly after, the bells came to Fort Russell, now F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne, and they've been here ever since. In August, Secretary Mattis told Congress about his plans to send the bells back to the Philippines, and today he's seeing that through.
We return these bells with consideration of our present, but also with the utmost respect of our past, one of shared sacrifice as co-equal brothers in arms.
At the ceremony, Mattis says returning the bells is a gesture of goodwill between the two countries.
History teaches us that nations with allies thrive.
But when Mattis first announced he planned to return the bells this summer, Wyoming's congressional delegation came out in opposition, and some local veterans groups said the bells were a war memorial and shouldn't be moved.
To those who fear that we lose something by returning the bells, please hear me when I say that bells mark time, but courage is timeless. It does not fade in history's dimly lit corridors, nor is it forgotten in history's compost.
Governor Matt Mead also speaks at the ceremony. He had previously been against returning the bells.
And I have been because I listen to our veterans. But I do know this, and listening to your words today, Secretary, you have a perspective that is broader than mine. You have a history that's broader than mine.
Since the bells arrived in Cheyenne, Philippine ambassadors and Catholic Church leaders have all tried to see the bells returned. Over a century later, they now begin their journey overseas. But first, they'll be refurbished in a facility in Philadelphia, then shipped to Korea, where a third bell waits on a U.S. airbase. From there, the three bells are expected to arrive in the Philippines before the end of the year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Wyoming is known for having one of the largest gender wage gaps in the country, but a comprehensive look at what men and women actually earn in the state had not been done in years. So in 2017, State Representatives Marty Halverson and Kathy Connolly teamed up to propose a study to better understand what was really going on. Now the study is finished, and legislators will have to decide what to do with this information. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard reports.
Among Wyomingites who worked full-time, year-round jobs in 2016, women earned 68 cents for every dollar earned by a man. That's the second widest gap in the nation, according to U.S. Census Bureau data, coming in just ahead of Louisiana. This comes from a study conducted by the Wyoming Department of Workforce Services and released in early October. Tony Glover is the manager of research and planning at the department. He says it's true. On the whole, women do earn less money than men in Wyoming.
But that difference between earnings varies widely depending on different factors like location, education levels, or industry.
The industry and the hours worked had quite a significant impact on the gender wage gap, with typically men working in goods producing industry and women working in services industry, and men typically working more hours than women.
Republican Marty Halverson helped bring forward the legislation that called for this study. She says her main fear was that the data would show systematic gender-based discrimination. But in looking at the study, she didn't see any evidence of that.
A simple word search of the document shows that discrimination is mentioned twice, and both times as, you know, qualified, as in this difference could be discrimination.
Halverson says in her view, most of the difference in earnings can be chalked up to the jobs and hours women choose to work. And as for getting women interested in STEM fields that generally have higher wages, she says these just aren't things that you can legislate.
I don't know how you can pass a law getting more women into science and tech. I don't know how you can pass a law making women work longer hours. I don't know how I could sit in Cheyenne and tell an employer, you must prohibit this, you must not do that, you must do the other thing. I don't see any legislative support for that.
Right now, there are three draft bills being developed for consideration in the legislative session. Halverson says she supports one of them, the so-called penalty parity bill. That means if a company violates equal pay laws, for example, paying a woman less for the same work as a man, it would be liable for up to $500 in penalties. The other sponsor of the legislation, Democrat Kathy Connolly, wants all three bills.
We've got an opportunity to kind of correct a problem here with some legislation.
As mentioned, the first is the penalty parity bill. The second measure will prohibit employers from retaliating against employees who discuss their wages. The third will promote attention to wage equality in state employment.
I, for one, certainly, you know, won't let us, you know, put our head in the sand. We need to act.
Republican Marty Halverson lost her bid for re-election earlier this month and will not be returning to the legislature in January. But Connolly says now that the study is finished, she will build new coalitions and relationships to get these issues heard.
But I really like the idea that we have two committees, both joint committees. So we're talking about 14 people on each of those committees, 28 out of 90 people. So almost a third of the legislature hearing about the issue before we go into session.
But key parts of the study still lacked data. There were 13 cents of the wage gap that could not be accounted for with things like fewer hours or different industry. Usually, that would point to discrimination. But Tony Glover at the Department of Workforce Services says that's not the case here.
The 13 cents on the dollars that remains unexplained, a lot of that is because of information we don't have. If we had more complete information, we'd probably have be able to account for more of the gap.
Glover says there are a few other things in the report they want to follow up on, like how men's and women's wages are impacted by becoming parents. But he says having more data on occupation and hours worked would give a clearer picture of the gap. The three draft bills will be presented to the Joint Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee meeting on Tuesday. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caroline Ballard.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the program or want to find an individual segment, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We can't cover the state and provide you with stories important to Wyoming without your financial support. If you appreciate our coverage, click on the Pledge Now button on our website.
Our shows are also available on podcast. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.